Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Thomas Ferguson, a professor emeritus of political science at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. He's the author of Golden Rule, The Investment Theory of Part Competition and the Logic of Money-Driven Political Systems, and the co-author of a new report from the Institute for New Economic Thinking, The Economic and Social Roots of Populist Rebellion, Support for Donald Trump in 2016. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Ferguson.
Hi, Ian. How you doing?
Well, not too bad. And, of course, there's a lot of anxiety now a couple of days before the elections and a lot of efforts to get the vote out. But I just was looking at some Republican GOP commercials that are running now saying that we don't want to go back to the Obama time. We don't want to stop this amazing recovery of the economy, and the implication being that somehow Obama ruined the economy and Trump rescued the economy. But the reality is that Obama inherited a free-falling economy, which fell apart on George W. Bush's watch. So is this to say, Tom, that you just simply can't expect truth and reality in politics anymore? I mean,
careful. I have my first response, I have to say, and would be anymore. My first question, because I am always impressed by the sort of funhouse character of all political ads, just about ever. Though I would agree that 30 years ago, the tenor of the distortions were different. But specifically on the economy, I actually have some trouble with everybody's positions on this, because I think you and I have been talking. We were talking at the time of the crash, and we all thought that Obama's response was half-size from what it was. And it was much better than Europe's. And in that respect, he certainly did make the United States economic situation a good deal better. You only have to go over to Europe to see how it's never recovered from 2008's problems. But on the other hand, it was only half the size of the stimulus they should have done, and it left out a lot of people. That's why we have Trump. That's basically the message of the paper that Ben Page and I and our other co-authors just put out of iNet, that we are finally able to track down, if you like, the economic roots of Trumpism, too. We don't disagree that there's plenty of racial resentment and misogyny sitting around in those votes. But there's also a very clear economic distress signs that were going there. And in that respect, we have taxed all this stuff that's appearing by people claiming they can't find any economic, if you like, influences on the vote in 2016. That's plain wrong, and there's not much you can say it. Now, specifically on the question of the recovery, Obama obviously has to be given credit for leaving the economy a bit better back than it was in 2008. I'm thinking of the pitches in 2015 and 16 where they were saying, well, we're all the way back. Now, everybody wasn't all the way back. That's one problem by itself. The other side of it, though, is that the Democratic mainstream economists have had a view of what the economy could do, technically its potential output, that has been too pessimistic for a long time. And, within a week or two after the election, the mainstream Democratic economists were saying that it was time for the Fed to raise rates. Janet Yellen and other people at the Fed were a bit more skeptical, and to their credit, they were slow doing it. But the truth is that the Trump people had a better view of what was going on there. I think they were correct when they said they had people on the sidelines and did not have to raise rates at that point. I mean, the argument being that if you run out of people, then you just get pure inflation and wages. We still haven't hit that point, though. Finally, we are hitting a bit, not a lot, of wage growth. I mean, that's another point. The Trump people tend to oversell their recovery. What they've been doing is effectively putting more people to work at the same wage rates. Now, the very last numbers made that look a little better, but, let's see, one swallow doesn't make a summer. And in that respect, I'd say the conventional discussion of the U.S. economy has underrated the number of people on the sidelines. They're still on the sidelines. Even prime age males, and I'm not picking on them for any other reason that that's your classic example you use for whether they're slack in the economy, that level of employment there is still not back to where it was before 2008 in terms of participation in the workforce. And you can say, well, yeah, some of these people are on drugs, et cetera. Yes, exactly. But, of course, a good deal of that drug response, I think, is clearly problems with despair over long-term unemployment. And in that respect, the U.S. is still, I think, hung over from 2008. And I don't like the Trump tax cuts were ridiculous. They're loaded to higher income. But in the short run, it did provide a big stimulus. And it was a stimulus that the Democrats ought to admit, most of the mainstream folks, I mean, there were a bunch of us who weren't mainstream saying, no, there's a lot of slack in the economy. That position was clearly right. All the claims that, you know, right after the election, within 2 weeks, lots of Democratic economists were calling for, say it was time for the Fed to raise, they were wrong. That's one thing I think we've learned from the last 2 years, which is a pretty interesting thing to learn. And I think we will all be sort of unpacking this for quite some time in the next few years. I mean, the mainstream view of potential output has been too pessimistic. It tends to just trail whatever output is, and then, with a little lag. And they need an independent assessment of that, to put it somewhat technically.
And again, I'm speaking with Thomas Ferguson, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. He's the author of Golden Rule, The Investment Theory of Part Competition and the Logic of Money-Driven Political Systems. And he's the co-author of a new report from the Institute for New Economic Thinking, The Economic and Social Roots of Populist Rebellion, Support for Donald Trump in 2016. So you've made the point that the birth of Donald Trumpism or Trumpism was in the 2008 crash, and that the analysis has largely been wrong, suggesting that it's all about racial resentment and dog whistle politics. Economic factors played a much, much larger role than previously acknowledged. But at this point, Tom, there's no question that Trump is doubling down on racial dog whistles and fear-mongering.
Yeah, he's doubling down on everything, including the economy, as you were observing right as you led into this, because essentially they're playing every theme in the book. And, you know, look, just to be clear, they were doing plenty of race baiting. They were doing some stuff that I'd call tacit closet anti-Semitism in some of those ads. Folks were playing just about everything. The full orchestra was playing in 2016. And for sure, race and misogyny were part of those appeals. They were part then, they're part now. On the other hand, you know, there are the economic appeals are also real. That's sort of the point in our paper, because huge numbers of folks have been saying they couldn't find any economic basis for the voting at all. I mean, there are books appearing even as I speak that, you know, make that claim. I don't think that's correct.
So how then, if Trump was able to get elected in 2016 by exploiting economic anxiety, now he's turning around and taking credit for a booming economy and saying it's the best it's ever been and he's the best president we've ever had. So how can that work then? If you, in 2016, you say you've been screwed by globalists and et cetera and by the Democrats, but now I've delivered you a booming economy. So you can't have it both ways.
Well, actually, right, the only question is going to be, is it really booming? And, you know, there it's a mixed case. I mean, except for the last numbers, which suggested some real wage growth, what you've been doing is putting more and more people back to work at either the same wages or indeed sometimes slightly lower. But employment was rising. No question about that. And for a lot of people on the periphery, not in places, in other words, where the economy has been booming, that's for real. That's a change that they notice. Now, You know, we're in a kind of gray zone here. Let's see what happens. And, you know, the right question to ask is what will be happening in 2020, I think. And, you know, that's basically if he's got wage growth going up still, then, you know, I think this guy's going to be a formidable candidate for reelection. I have never taken the view that Trump's or his campaigns were foolish. I never thought that. And I think they do stuff in a pretty calculated way. I regret a lot of what they do, but they do it. And so, you know, you can have it both ways in the sense that you can say, I've taken an economy. Let's see what happens. You know, I mean, the economic situation of a lot of Americans has somewhat improved. Now, we also know that, like, the tax cuts for a lot of lower income and average people are going to sunset very fast. And, you know, there's the great bulk of the tax cut was loaded to upper income people. All of this is true. The question's going to be what's happening in the economy. You know, there's a view that somehow this can't be anything but smoke and mirrors. It is smoke and mirrors in the sense it's front loaded, it's rushed through. But you know, there's no question that employment has been going up. And not at necessarily at higher wages. Only in the last numbers was there any suggestion of that. By last, I mean only a few days ago. But for folks who've seen no hiring in their town for a long time, which I think it does hit a lot of rural and semi-rural America as well as small towns, that's going to play. You know, I'll just have to see what happens here.
Well, but he's definitely done well for the wealthy. We know that. And that the middle-class tax cuts that he promised actually went to the super rich and a few multinational corporations. And recently talking about promising a middle-class tax cut before the election, even though the House was not in session, was so absurd. But it was a de facto recognition that the original tax cuts for the fraudulent tax cuts for the middle class, which were for the super rich, weren't working for him. So that much is clear, but we know that the deficit's being blown out. We'll have $1 trillion deficits for the next 4 years.
Janet Yellen agrees that is not looking good, and that's going to cause trouble.
Janet Yellen just said the other day that they're unsustainable. So again, you know, when you talk about front-loading, it's pretty cynical, isn't it, to have an artificial boost so that you get reelected or you hold on to the House and Senate. But the long-term damage is pretty profound.
It's totally cynical. It's not, I wouldn't regard it all as long-term damage, but I certainly think deficits of the size they're talking about are going to be a problem. And I'm assuming that they don't slide back into recession when I say that. There's one other issue here that is unpopular to mention, but I think it probably merits, which is Trump is also delivering some tariffs. Now, look, the tariff question is enormously controversial, but our research left no doubt at all that a lot of people were, if you were looking to explain blue-collar white support of Trump, tariffs was something that a lot of people liked. In there, it definitely distinguished Trump in the Republican primary in 2016, and it helped him in the general election too. And I'm not trying to tell you that tariffs are wonderful. I'm simply saying they're popular. Now, my own take on the tariff discussion is hugely complicated because, you know, it's obvious that if you have a world at full employment and investment is everywhere as high as you want it, as you think it should be, then free trade's got to be the best policy. You want folks. At the same time, we're very far from that in this world. And so, you know, in that type of situation, it's not so obvious that trade diversion doesn't sometimes make jobs. That's a relatively point of view that, you know, multinationals that move everywhere think that's just terrible. But, you know, it may, in fact, be true. I do think that the existing trade theories don't work very well out what happens in situations where everybody is below the level of full employment, though the U.S. is beginning to approach that. It's not there yet. You know, as I said, even prime age males you know, 26, 34, and they're still not in the labor force to the extent they were.
Right. But don't you think that
2008? So this is a mess. I mean, it's a very strange environment. And so,
but don't you think,
though,
Tom, there's an element of racist nationalism in
absolutely.
These that's the
absolutely.
Whole idea. He's basically saying, you know, it's the Chinese that are screwing us, and we got to America first, and that the Democrats are in favor of globalism, and I'm in favor of nationalism, and look at all those people coming up from Central America that are going to take your jobs away.
Yep.
I mean, there's no,
no
question.
That's absolutely clear. We found that in our paper. We actually say there's even an interaction between the demand for import relief and being white. We have evidence of that. I'm not disagreeing with you. That's clearly the case.
Well, what can be done,
that
though?
That said, there's still a question about what do you do about trade policy. Yeah.
Right, but in the 2 days before the vote, I don't think the Democrats have been able to counter Trump's dog whistles in terms of, you know, the brown people are coming to invade us and the yellow people are stealing us blind. That's basically his message.
Well, it's part of his pitch, along with look what I'm doing for you in the economy. But now, yeah, I mean, I actually think it's an absolutely perfect piece of political theater to sort of focus on that caravan business, because it does highlight a weakness in the Democrats. You know, they don't have any clear policy that I can find to sort of deal with that, except to say, well, we have border controls. Well, yes, but, you know, and you got folks in there saying we should just abolish the border. Folks, I think they clearly need a radical restructuring. Not much doubt about that. But the truth is, the Democrats have a problem here in terms of the bulk of the population does not want to see sort of anything like open borders. And you can't get a clear statement out of Schumer, Pelosi, or anybody else on this question. And I think they're going to have to deal with this at some point.
Well, Thomas Ferguson, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
All right. Thanks. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Thomas Ferguson, who's Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. He's the author of Golden Rule, The Investment Theory of Part Competition and the Logic of Money-Driven Political Systems, and co-author of a new report from the Institute for New Economic Thinking, The Economic and Social Roots of Populist Rebellion, Support for Donald Trump in 2016. And we're going to take a brief station break and back looking into how the Republicans are rigging the vote and how the American right is on the way to permanent minority rule.